and welcome to another edition of Focal Point. My name is Phil Vanderpeer. On the other side of the desk is Peter Greco, who's waiting to tell you all about tonight's program. Peter, what have we got?
Very shortly, Phil, we'll catch up with Bernadette Packer, who is a music teacher and has just in recent times learnt a different way of teaching, so we'll find out more about that. We'll then catch up with the winner of an award at the Doggone Hunters Australia convention or conference that was held on the weekend. We'll hear about that. We'll then catch up with Andy Griffiths, who's doing an amazing event as far as raising funds for a very worthy charity goes. And then being the second Wednesday of the month, we'll catch up with someone from the Blind Sporting Council. In fact, we'll catch up from Victoria Beach, who's doing work in particularly the area of town and cycling. We've got a birthday call to do. And at 8 o'clock tonight, we'll have Talking Vision with Stephen Jolly.
Right. And now, Peter, we're going to be talking about something that's very different. What's the story?
Well, a number of years ago, Phil, we spoke to Bernadette Packer, who actually spent some time in Adelaide at the craniofacial unit, and it's great to welcome Bernadette back to the program. Bernadette, how are you going?
I'm well, thank you, Peter. Yes.
Now, how are things going with you? Of course, it was quite some time ago that you spent some time in Adelaide, and then I believe you come back.
I did, yes. That was back in the late 70s, early 80s, on and off. In fact, I was back with the fourth to Adelaide for medical, surgeries and so forth, yes. And I still go back occasionally, for checkups, yeah, for ENT, yes.
Now, you also teach music?
Yes, I do.
How's that going? I believe in recent times you've taken on a new course.
Yes, that's right. I've been teaching music or piano, actually, since about 1990 I started. I started taking piano students within the home sort of thing. At the same time that I was doing a diploma of music and a bachelor of music degree and all that sort of thing, and I was teaching privately, and then I did a lot of home visits and things like that, getting around in the cane, and I finally got a bit sick of that because it was just catching buses everywhere and you can't really take on too many when you can't drive. So then I ended up in a school. I somehow found myself a school who were able to take me in, that I could actually just teach all the students in the one sort of classroom, so to speak, individually. And then finally I decided to do another method of music teaching course called Suzuki Method of Teaching.
How did you hear about it? Is it something that was fairly well known?
I'd actually known about it actually on and off over the years. It was criticised a little bit, but I heard about it through a friend of mine just recently who knew of someone who was doing it and who said that the course was used, not only they actually use this approach to teach very young children, so even toddlers and possibly 4 or 5 year olds, but it's also used to teach students with special needs as well.
Okay.
And that's how I heard about it, and I suddenly was inspired to take on that approach because I thought I'd been doing traditional teaching for years, with sighted students, and I thought this is an area I'd like to look into. So I started a course and have been enjoying it ever since.
An extra string to your bow, as it were.
I beg your pardon?
An extra string to your bow in terms of the people that you can teach.
Yes.
So I think you started the course back in May?
Yes, that's correct.
How long does the course go for?
Goes for about 18 months.
Right.
It's an accreditation course. It's not necessarily a university course. There are some academics involved, but more, I think a lot of the learning actually comes with me, with the practical. If you're going to learn to demonstrate to children, and it's not only involving children either on their own, which is what I like, it's also involving the family, like parents. Because I was finding more and more in my traditional teaching that a lot of the times you teach the kids and you don't always, the parents are just often so busy, which is understandable, but this is actually involves the parents, which is one of the philosophies of Suzuki. And also for them to learn the music of language in the same way that children learn the mother tongue.
Have you found going back to learning yourself?
Well, before I started learning, I was playing by ear, so I was told. Apparently, I began playing when I was about 3 and a half, just tunes and things like that I just didn't, you know, just heard of, you know, like church and other events and so forth. And then I just started to play around with it. And then I just began to learn when I went to school in Sydney that I learnt off someone there, one of the young teachers there actually, and just Felix Seven Nations and so forth. By the time I finished school, I got on to some, learned off some fairly good teachers actually, and then just went on to further study. And I've got down here to Melbourne, so yeah.
And how have you found going back to school in a sense to learn in the last few months?
Going back to school, well...
Well, to learn the Suzuki method, how have you found that?
Well, school, I suppose it didn't really feel like school. Lectures were really only about once a month.
Okay.
And there's tutorials every couple of weeks, you know, like at night and so forth. So they're very spaced out, actually. But there's quite a bit of work to do in between, a bit of practice and a bit of, you know, work like writing out some teaching points in point forms and, you know, an essay or two and sort of thing. But it's the academic doesn't actually take over at all. It's just part of just reading about familiarising what the philosophy is really all about, which is really quite different to the traditional methods.
Can you sort of summarise it, or is it a bit difficult?
I can. I think... To summarise what the Suzuki method is really what Suzuki was, a musician himself, and his philosophy was that children, young, you know, from a very young age, can learn the language of music in the same way that they learn the from the mother tongue. Like, for example, they have to learn that the very first words are actually from the mother or from the parents or whoever is raising them.
Mm.
They can learn music. They learn music at the same age. They can actually sort of learn the language of music by repetition, you know, and so forth, and being surrounded by constantly recorded music or listening to music. So it's learning the language of music at a very young age, and then up that way they're able to internalise it and able to, you know, express it.
So not much theory as such, or less theory?
No, well, the actual music reading comes in later on.
Mm.
It was criticism that the, you know, like those who were actually learning Suzuki were... Oh, no, they just didn't want to read. Now, I did have about three students, and I'm talking about 20 years ago, who had learned through the music, like piano leads, through the Suzuki method. Oh, no, they just did not want to learn to read music at all, and that was the end of that one. They just didn't...
Yeah.
But now they've modified that, and they no longer just leave it too late. So that's basically the questions I raised about that in one of the lectures. And their reply to me was, well, yeah, that's a very fair criticism because they left it too long and now they just introduced it at the end of book one and earlier on. But memorising is one thing that's really important and that's what they still introduce. But reading is something, well, they want to learn, take up further study later on, or if they're performing, it's good to have something in front of them.
Now, you said you're teaching piano. Is the Suzuki method mainly used for piano or can it be used for any sort of...
No, it's for other instruments. I can't quite say whether a violin piano is the obvious one, but they're actually expanding to other instruments as well, yes.
So is it a way, in a way, sort of making it more fun and less sort of regimented, maybe a bit more instinctive?
I beg your pardon?
Is it making it probably a bit more fun or a bit more instinctive as far as learning music goes? Would that
yes,
be?
Yes, much more instinctive, yes. Yes, it is. It's more, possibly in a way, more a positive approach, more enjoyable because it's really about, just praising the child for what they're doing right, but also saying... Well, this is what we need to work on and so forth. It's really not about, that was very poor, you know, style of playing or that was, you played a few wrong notes here and the kind of thing because it's really, you really have to sort of, you know, it's building into what enjoying the music means rather than just saying, try to get every note right and the notes all wrong and all that, you know, kind of thing. It's just, it's not all about being critical. That's what I mean. That's what I'm trying to say. Yes.
Well, Bernadette, good luck with it. So you've got maybe another year or so of the course of itself to go. Can you start teaching Suzuki style yet, or do you have to wait till you finish the course?
I had to do a lot more observations lessons before I could actually do that. I mean, go and observe all the some of the other Suzuki teachers teaching.
Yeah.
Yes, before I could actually start taking on Suzuki students myself. And then, of course, once I do, then some of it has to be done. I had to give a bit of a demo on that as well. So, which is all part of it. So, yeah. So it won't be for a little while, yes. And I've got quite a bit going on at the moment, so.
Well, we thank you for chatting to us about it, and we wish you well with it. It'll be good to catch up with you down the track to see how it pans out, whether it does get more people involved.
Yes, yep, absolutely. Thank you very much for your time, Peter.
Thanks, Bernadette.
No worries. Bye.
Bernadette Packer, a music teacher, and also at the moment learning to teach the Suzuki way of teaching as well. So about a third of the way through the course, I'm sure we'll hear more from Bernadette in the future.
We'll come back after this very short break. And, of course, you're listening to Focal Point on 5RPH, 1197 and digital radio.
At Vision Australia, we support children like 12-year-old Moana every day. Moana was born with a rare genetic eye condition, resulting in her having severely low vision, seeing only shades of light and dark. Growing up with a vision impairment can be challenging, but it doesn't have to define someone. Through the generous support of the Australian public, our staff here at Vision Australia develop specifically designed school holiday programs for children who are blind or have low vision. The children get to take part in fun activities such as cooking and sports, as well as learning self-care and mobility skills. The focus of these programs is to build up the child's confidence, abilities, and belief in themselves. But we can't continue these vital services without your help. Please consider donating today. You'll be giving young people like Moana the support they need to live a life of inclusion, learning and achievement. Call 1-800-422-077 or donate online at visionaustralia.org/donate. Thank you.
Welcome back to the program. Now, Peter, which way are we going this time?
Well, last weekend in Adelaide, Australia, in fact, Adelaide hosted the inaugural conference for Dog Guide Handlers Australia. I believe it was a very, very big success. One of the things that happened was the announcement of the inaugural Judith Killen Golden Harness, and the winner is Rowena Dowling. And it's great to welcome Rowena to the program.
No, I don't think she's on the line at the moment. We're still waiting to actually get her on the line, so tell us about some of the things that are happening, particularly on LeisureLink this weekend.
Well, one of the things we'll be doing on LeisureLink 2.0 at 8:30 tonight is catching up with Rachel Henderson, who's just back from a trip to Japan playing golf ball, and it's Rachel's birthday, so a happy birthday to Rachel Henderson, one of our top young athletes. I think Rowena Dowling is there now. Rowena was one of the people that attended the inaugural conference for Dog Guide Handlers Australia and was awarded the Judith Killen Golden Harness. Rowena, welcome and congratulations.
Oh, thank you, Peter.
Were you aware of the fact that you were in the running for this award?
Yes, it was a bit of a surprise, but I was honoured to receive it. You would be aware that Dog Guide Handlers Australia had its first convention in Adelaide this month, and it was the first time that the award had been presented, so I was honoured to be the first recipient. I'd like to accept it in honour of the memory of Judith Killen, who was actually the founding member of Dog Guide Handlers Australia and sadly passed away a couple of years ago. So it was an honour to receive it in her memory. She was a great advocate for people who are blind or vision impaired and people in particular who use dog guides.
It's interesting. Some of the notation from the award was outstanding efforts for fostering, representing, promoting, enhancing and protecting the interest of people blind or vision impaired, particularly those using a dog guide.
That's right. That's the vision and mission statement of Dog Guide Handlers Australia, and I was pleased to be one of the four founding members of the association and have been involved in the group since its inception. And I guess as a dog guide handler myself, I'm pretty passionate about advocacy and peer support and information and just the dog guide movement in general. And I was really pleased to see our first convention go off so well, and I'm pleased to see DGHA going from strength to strength and achieving our objectives, and I hope we'll go on to bigger and better things in the future.
What were some of the highlights from the weekend from your point of view?
Unfortunately, I was unable to attend the convention, but I believe that everybody was having a great time. I mean, when I tuned into the AGM and various events, they sounded like they're having a great time. One of the benefits of the conference was it had a very interesting program of workshops. And really, what we aim to achieve is peer support and sharing information, networking with guide dog agencies and around Australia. So I think it really achieved that aim.
Rowan, it's one of the things these days, I guess maybe more than ever, that people who are blind or vision impaired are out there in the community, and they maybe do their dog guide training and then go away and perhaps don't have a lot of interaction with other people who might be using dog guides as well.
Yeah, I think that is a big problem, especially in rural and regional areas in Australia, where vision impaired people who don't live in major cities probably don't have the support networks and easy access to services that people in the larger communities do. And I mean, I live on Magnetic Island in North Queensland, so I'm one of those rural or regional people. And it's so important. I mean, it's the peer support we get from being together and sharing of information and resources. And sort of one of my passions, I guess, would be advocating for equal access to client services throughout Australia, regardless of where you live, be it in a city or a regional or rural area. So I think that's really the value of an organisation like DGHA.
Is there a bit of a lack of opportunity for people in rural areas to get that access, do you think?
I think so. Yes, I mean, a lot of places don't have vision impaired services or guide dog services, seeing eye dog services. So that one of the benefits of DGHA is that we do meet from all around Australia by telephone. We have interesting guest speakers and, it's just this first get-together in Adelaide was such a great opportunity to meet people that you may have spoken to on the phone or over email, over the internet, meet them in person and really share that support. So, it was fantastic that we had people from, I think, most states in Australia and a lot of regional and rural people coming in, so it's just very good for that, yeah.
And I guess the first time first time people that have had dog guides, but maybe some that were on maybe their third or fourth or even fifth dog?
Yes. Yeah, that sharing of experience from our members that have had very wide experience from handling different dogs. And I think there was a few first-time handlers there that had not been matched or working with their dog for very long in Adelaide. And it was, I think that, feedback from experienced handlers is such a valuable thing.
Rowan, what about access generally? It doesn't seem that in some respects it has improved much. I sort of, something appealed to my funny nature when, someone like Graham Innes, who's the Disability Discrimination Commissioner, gets refused to enter into a cab with his guide dog. You're picking on the wrong guy there as far as a cab driver goes, but it's probably not really, there's obviously still a discrimination out there.
There is, and it's sad to see that even with all the community education, public relations work that goes on, and people with disabilities, getting out and about in the community and being in positions such as Graham Innes, you just think, how can this ignorance still exist? So unfortunately, it does, and I think that's one of the great things that DGHA can help to, educate and alleviate in the future. I think it's just so important to keep up with the advocacy and educating the public and striving for the rights and interests of people who are disadvantaged or disabled. So, I think DGHA does a great job in promoting that cause.
I guess it's like any campaign, Rowena. Every now and then the public needs to be reminded, even though they might have heard the message before. Sometimes if it's, out of sight or out of mind, that reminding message needs to come out.
It does, indeed, yeah. And I think people with any disability, it's important that we work together to sort of promote general understanding of disability and certainly to be refused access with a dog guide to a taxi or any other venue is an ongoing problem and one that just shouldn't happen in this day and age and in this country. But, it's good to see the profile of people with disability you know, improving and increasing and expanding all the time in Australia. And it's organisations like DGHA, I guess, Blind Citizens Australia, Vision Australia and others that help us to achieve all those objectives.
And the abilities of the dogs themselves, I mean, you know, in terms of where they might work, it might be in the middle of a very, very busy city, or as you said, in a very non-metropolitan area, their abilities probably never cease to amaze, and maybe that the dog guide handlers themselves.
That is such a true comment. I'm on my second dog now. My first was trained in Sydney and worked in Sydney, and my current dog is working in a very unstructured island environment, so it's astounding that they can be trained to work in all these sort of unstructured and differing environments, and they do such a good job. And I mean, I know that people in the public must look at them in awe and think, aren't they marvellous, which is a comment you hear so often. I think people do forget that they are just dogs, and they have all the dog distractions and things, but you know, they do such a wonderful job, any working dog does. And I've always said that my dog guides are just an extension of myself. And I guess a dog guide team that's working together, the dog and their handler, is the best advocacy and public education, because you work well together and it gives you that confidence to get out and about with mobility, and people see that and, you know, are duly impressed. So I guess that's probably the best education and advocacy tool that we have as dog guide handlers.
What's life like on Magnetic Island for a dog guide?
It's a challenge. It's a very unstructured environment. We have virtually no footpaths, curbs or corners, and, you know, it's never been a planned community. So there's huge challenges for dog guides, but there's two people here now that are vision impaired dog guide handlers.
Okay.
Quite a number of people who are vision impaired who tap about with their canes, and although we do meet with nasty accidents on occasion, we all still live here, so it's a pretty nice place to live.
I was going to say, it sounds very, very appealing, Magnetic Island off the Queensland coast.
Yes.
Well, congratulations again on the award. Obviously, you know, the fact that you're the inaugural winner of the Judith Killen Golden Harness is something no one will be able to take away from you. And obviously, the great work that you did in setting up the organisation with people like Judith in the early days has been well recognised. So, again, congratulations. And I know that I don't think I'm letting too many cats out of the bag without mixing metaphors, that I think it looks like in a couple of years' time you might be back in Adelaide, or Dog Guide Handlers Australia might be back in Adelaide with another conference.
That's fantastic. We're hoping to have a conference every 2 years.
Yeah.
And Adelaide is a very centralised and accessible venue, of course, for people from all around Australia. That's the attraction of Adelaide, is that you can come from any direction by many different ways of transport. But we are hoping to rotate the conferences as well through the different capital cities to give as many people the chance to attend as can. So, yeah, it's great to have our first one, and I look forward to many more.
Now, people can find out more from your website?
Indeed. If people would like more information or to join DGHA, go to our website, which is DGHA for Dog Guide Handlers Australia. So dgha.org.au, or you can email us at dgha.org.au.
Terrific, Rowena. Again, congratulations and thanks for the chat.
My pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
That's Rowena Dowling there, the inaugural winner of the Judith Killen Golden Harness Award, and as I said, for outstanding efforts fostering, representing, promoting and enhancing and protecting the interest of people blind or vision impaired with dog guides. That's a fantastic citation, and obviously a very worthy winner, and more winners to come in the future, I'm sure.
We'll come back after this very short break on 5RPH, and the program is Focal Point.
Thursday night at 8, RPH Adelaide brings you up to date with the weekend's SANFL matches with the SANFL League Team Show. We'll tell you who's in and who's out of your team, plus bring you in-depth interviews with all the SANFL clubs. The SANFL League Team Show, Thursday nights at 8, only on your premier SANFL station, 1197 AM, RPH Adelaide and digital radio.
And if you're tuned on a digital radio, good to have you along. And if you haven't got a digital radio, then perhaps you should go out and buy one. And certainly you'll appreciate the good sound that comes from a digital radio. And when you get one, just look for RPH Adelaide and you'll see us there on your dial, and you'll hear us in the crystal clear sound. Now, Peter, our next interview is...
Well, Andrew Griffiths is an optometrist and does some work at the Royal Society for the Blind. That's what he does by day, but by weekends or at night, Andy's got a very big challenge coming up later on this month, in fact. That's great to welcome Andy to the program. Andy, thank you for your time.
You know, problems at all.
Now, you're a bit of an old stager at this, aren't you? The Simpson Desert Challenge?
Yes, I didn't learn the first three occasions. and for some stupid reason, I thought for my 60th birthday year challenge, this hadn't been 60, wasn't tough enough. I decided to try and challenge the desert again.
What's involved with it? For those that might have heard about it but not exactly sure, what does the challenge actually involve?
Okay, well, basically, there's a thing called the Simpson Desert in the northern part of our state, and there's a bicycle race every year across it, and it's 600 kilometres a race in 4.5 days.
Crikey.
Across some of the world's toughest, we reckon it's the toughest bike race in the world, and we like to keep that moniker associated with it.
Now, Andy, how much is it you against you, and how much is it a competition?
Well, look, for me, the competition is against the desert. So the idea for me is to cross from end to end without getting swept by the sweet vehicle. I don't go there to beat anybody else. Mind you, if I see someone ahead of me and they've only got a couple of minutes for me, there's only one goal, to get past them. I must admit. But I ain't ever going to win this event. But my deal is to beat the desert, basically. And to me, that's a tough enough challenge.
So what sort of bike do you ride? Does everyone ride a similar sort of bike?
Well, it's changed over the years. Look, I used to race what's called a regular mountain bike, and in the old imperial terms, those have tires about 2.5 inches wide. I've got to remember your average little road bike, the like the lizards have to go for their coffee on a Saturday morning or something, but they'd have 1-inch wide tires. So that's already, I'll let you do the arithmetic, 2.5 times as wide.
Yeah.
But this year, my off-road bike's got, it's called a fat bike, and as the name implies, something's fat on it, and it's the tires that are fat. They're 4-inch tires this year.
Does it make it easier or harder?
Well, I'm about to find out.
Good answer.
No, it should make it easier because obviously we run them incredibly low tire pressures, probably about 9 psi, and that gives you a nice big wide footprint. So instead of digging into this soft sand, you basically, hopefully, that's the plan, glide across the surface. So when it comes to a big thick sand dune, instead of having to get up and portage your bike, if your little legs will carry you, you can cycle on through it. So that's what it's about.
And of course you hope that there's nothing in the sand that will cause a puncture.
Well, punches is a major problem. I must admit, in all the previous times I've done it, I've escaped with not one single puncture, which is probably just more luck than judgment, yeah. I have to say, because it's certainly what we call Prickle City out there. If anybody's ever travelled in the desert, they'll know. It's when you get back, you're pulling prickles and thorns out of your clothes and gear for months afterwards. So, and they go straight through tires, and next thing you've got a flat, and that's the worst thing you need. That's right.
Andy, how sort of structured is the course? Is it a fairly well-defined track?
Well, a track's the right word. We basically, this year, we're following what's called the classic route, which is the Rig Road. Now, the Rig Road was put in by the French oil company back in the late 50s. They laughingly call it a road. What they did was they basically clay-topped the sand dunes because they thought they were going to find a lot of oil out there. But there's been no maintenance since 1960, basically. So they did the sums on that, so that's 54 years. So it's all cracked up. And, of course, it's the ultimate four-wheel drive destination. Now, you've got a four-wheel drive, you ain't been anywhere until you've crossed the Simpson Desert. But basically, it's just sand, corrugations, sand dunes. Not much difference the whole way.
What happens at night? Where do you sleep?
Well, basically, we sleep out in the Million Star Motel. We sleep out under the stars, basically. And it's probably not a very friendly place to be because obviously there's no showers while we're out there. And we have to take all our own supplies, our own food, our own water. And certainly, it can get quite cold at night, of course, in the desert. I mean, I just looked at the temperature in Birdsville yesterday, 35 degrees there already.
Yeah.
And they haven't had any rain for about 4 or 5 months. And that's not cocky speak either. That's real. They haven't had rain for 4 or 5 months. Yeah. I checked the figures. So it's going to be very dry, very hot,
dusty,
and very sandy.
What about as far as wildlife goes? I don't mean partying at night. I mean the critters that might be out there.
It's look, it's an amazing playthrough. You cannot believe it. At night, you can wander around at night without even a flashlight, in the, with no moon. It's just so much, so many stars out there. And the noise at night is quite deafening with all the critters. Daytime, look, the main critters we see, the odd dingo, quite a few camels, unfortunately, and they're, of course, you're getting more and more of those. And of course, it's snakes. I just heard on the radio this morning saying snakes are coming out of hibernation. And they're mean mamas this time. Yeah, they're very hungry. So I probably lean mean cyclist looks quite nice, easy tucker throw, I reckon.
So what can you do to minimise your chances of having such an encounter?
Cycle real quick.
Of course. can you do stuff, or is it literally luck?
I think it's just luck, basically. Look, this time of year, the snakes are a bit sluggish because they obviously haven't fed for a few months, and they tend to be very, very defensive indeed. So that if you don't want to get, like anybody else, you don't want to get too close to them. I mean, I've been lucky. I've only, in 1 year, I've only ever seen one snake out there, and because we always race this time of year. So I've been lucky so far. I mean, we haven't had any casualties so far. We haven't anybody who's been bitten by a snake. But, you know, it's always a risk, shall we say. You know?
Now, I know an ophthalmologist, Dr. Gary Davis, is doing it, I think, for the first time this year.
Yeah, he's my fellow. He's my inductee this year. I travel out back with Gary twice a year, and we've been travelling for about 15, 16 years. You know, I've been on his case because he's an elite ultra-marathon runner. So I said, come on, Gary, come to do really tough this time. So we've teamed up. We've both got new bicycles, both got fat bikes, and we're going to keep each other company for the desert, and hopefully we'll both cross the finishing line together.
And Gary, you're both of you doing it for a good cause as well?
Yeah, this year we're... pardon me. I got the flu a couple of days ago, which is not the good time to get it.
Not good time.
Yeah, we're raising funds for Flying Doctor this year, and that's been our because obviously, despite the fact we all have a lot of fun, masochistical fun doing it, at the end of the day, it's a fundraiser for charities. And for the last 5 years, we've been raising funds for Royal Flying Doctor.
So how much of the track that you'll be doing is uphill and down dale? I mean, is it like that, or is it pretty well flat?
Basically, it's about 1,100 sand dunes we have to cross, some of which no more than just make a bleep on the bicycle radar, but some of them at the eastern edge of the desert are just ginormous sand dunes, and I guarantee even the most elite riders won't be riding up these dunes. You've got to get up and portage your bike, and a lot of these dunes aren't even traversable by four-wheel drives. You've basically got to take detours and chicken tracks and things like that. So yeah, it's a pretty hard terrain. A friend of mine who come from Switzerland has done a lot of bike racing around the world, and there's an event very far north of Australia called the Crocodile Run, and they say that's the toughest ride, but he says, look, Crocodile Run for boys, Switzerland Desert for men.
Well, Andy, it's great to talk to you. We wish you well. It'll be good to catch up with you when you've done it to tell us how it goes.
I'll tell you what, I'll send you the picture of my backside, and I'll tell you how I've done it. All right, Peter.
Thanks, Andy. Good luck. Bye, and good luck to Gary as well.
Cool. Thanks. Bye.
That's Andy Griffiths there, who's an optometrist with the Royal Society for the Blind, and also doing the Simpson Desert Challenge. We wish them well, and hopefully maybe on a LeisureLink in the next Saturday or two, we'll try and catch up with Dr. Gary Davis, who's an ophthalmologist who's also doing it for the first time. Andy, this is his fourth occasion, so we wish them well.
We'll come back after this very short break with the final of our interviews. This is 5RPH, 1197 on the AM band, and of course on your digital radio.
More than 20% of pedestrians killed on our roads have a blood alcohol content exceeding 0.15. Never let a mate walk home drunk.
Welcome back. And Peter, our next interview should be rather interesting. Actually,
yes,
Blind Sports, isn't it?
Yes, the Blind Sporting Council normally put us onto an interview for each second Wednesday of each month, and tonight we're going to speak to Victoria Veach, who's from Euroride Mercedes-Benz Adelaide, and she's the sport director there, and they've very much involved with the tandem program for people riding bikes. And of course, we just spoke to Andy Griffiths, who's about to go across the Simpson Desert. I think these bikes might go a little bit quicker, and it's great to welcome Victoria to the program. Victoria, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Now, you've got a fundraiser coming up to help you with the work that you do?
We do. We have a great gala event at the Mercedes-Benz Adelaide dealership next Thursday. It'll be our first, and we're really looking forward to it.
Okay. Whereabouts is it, and what will be happening?
Well, it'll be at the dealership itself. So we have a broad range of invitations going out, and we encourage anyone who wants to find out about the event to jump onto our team website, the URIDE Mercedes-Benz Adelaide Racing website. So it's going to be a really fun night. I mean, you know, cyclists like to do things a little bit out of the ordinary. So we're going to have, obviously, the very beautiful Mercedes in the dealership. Mercedes have just launched their new C-Class, so they're very proud of their new vehicle. And we've got some amazing tandems on display. Our old tandems have been custom painted by Cafasso Auto Bodies. So they're the only tandems that we know of in Australia with custom artwork. And they're absolutely beautiful machines. We'll be having some racing and some fantastic food provided by one of our sponsors, Hugh and Salmon, and obviously some brilliant wine from Honeymoon and Naringa Wineries.
Sounds great. And what's the website if people do want to find out more?
So that's the URIDE Mercedes-Benz Adelaide Racing.
Okay, and URIDE is E-U-R-I-D-E?
That's it.
Terrific. Victoria, you obviously work with a number of cyclists who have a vision impairment. How did you first get involved?
Well, our team actually has had a very long association with vision impaired riding. The captain of our program, Mike Hoyle, was actually Kieran Modra's training partner for 10 years.
Okay.
One of our other elite riders, Matthew Miller, also piloted Kieran at world championship level. So those two boys have been riding for our team for many, many years and, you know, always rode around on the tandem. And they spent 8 years trying to get people to be pilots unsuccessfully. So we decided, well, let's apply a team approach to this situation and actually source the pilots from our team so that we've got skillful riders, we've got elite riders, and we've also got riders who already have a sense of loyalty to want to do something that's beyond just racing for our team. And that's when it took off.
Now, one of the exciting things that happened at the Commonwealth Games was, of course, Stephanie Morton, who has been a front rider for Felicity Johnson, actually won a gold medal in her own right, which is fantastic. Does it take a special kind of rider to ride a tandem bike, particularly as a pilot?
Look, I guess the one thing that I would say, I mean, it doesn't really matter, you know, the level of fitness. I mean, obviously, that's something that a pilot and stoker can work on together. But in general, you need somebody who's been riding for a while. There is quite a bit of responsibility to being a pilot. It's you're taking decisions for two people. You're handling a much heavier piece of equipment, and sometimes in really high performance situations. And while people don't necessarily need to start at that level, even to begin on a tandem, you're going to want to have some grounding with cycling in general.
Mm-hmm. And what about the the responsibilities and the communication? Is that something that the two riders sort of work out amongst themselves, or is there sort of a code, if you like, that everyone uses?
Well, in general, I mean, when we train our squad, they're all trained to be identical in terms of, you know, we want to produce riders that have a very high criteria of skills. Now, that starts off with verbal communication, obviously. You know, you want to be telling them what's coming up. Some of them have absolutely no vision whatsoever, and some of them are able to use partial vision. And for a pilot, it's very different depending on who you've got. You know, to have a totally blind rider, you can feel, you know, that the machine is just different. But what we train our riders is that they need to go beyond the verbal communication and they need to read the pedals. You know, it's no point being in a race situation and your pilot needing to accelerate and having to tell the stoker about it because everyone's going to be listening. So, you know, when...
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so, you know, they need to become more subtle and feel the drag on the pedals. And they also need to feel when the pilot is backing off. And eventually, as they advance through the program and they develop that level of skill, then they can feel what the bike is doing with far less verbal communication.
Well, sounds like it's a very exciting thing. Do you have more pilots that want to get involved, or do you have more people who are blind or vision impaired wanting to get involved? What's the sort of ratio there?
Yeah, well, we actually need a bigger pilot ratio to stoker. At the moment, we've got about 15 to 16 regular pilots. The reason why the pilots have to outnumber the stokers is because as members of a race team, we already have obligations. We have obligations to represent at various races. We have obligations to teams racing and team-specific training sessions. Now, while many of those do involve the tandems, some of the training is very team-specific, like our Criterium team preparing itself. So we need backup pilots because, you know, we commit to getting our vision-impaired riders out on the road no less than twice a week. And when we're preparing for nationals, we often have our riders out on the road four times a week.
Mm.
No other program in Australia has the commitment to human resources that we have, but that is necessary because you can't overburden a small population of pilots when we're already responsible for representing our team in racing.
I don't want to burn them out. Mm. Well, Victoria, sounds fantastic. We'll chat to you more in the future, but meanwhile, that fun race is such tomorrow week.
Yes, that's right.
And to give us those details again, when, where, and also if people do want to find out more.
Sure. So it's going to be at the Mercedes-Benz Adelaide dealership. It starts at 6:30, so it's designed to be an after-work function. Lots of fun, great food, and brilliant wine. And the details can be sourced on our Uride Mercedes-Benz Adelaide Racing website. And that website also has all of our athlete profiles. So if you want to know who these fantastic vision-impaired athletes are, all the information is there.
Terrific. Victoria, good luck. And as I said, we'll chat again.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
That's Victoria Veach there, who's involved with Euroride Mercedes-Benz Adelaide. She's the sports director and obviously doing some great work with their tandem program. Phil, I know this week nominations closed for people wanting to nominate to stand for the local government election. If you know someone who's blind or vision impaired, or indeed if you are and you've nominated, give us a call, 8234 1198. It'd be good to have a chat to you on air. If you know anyone with a disability that's nominated, 8234 1198 or 5RPH at visionaustralia.org. It'd be good to get you on the program in the next couple of months to chat about why you're doing such a thing.
That's it for this week. We do hope that you've enjoyed the program and that you'll be able to join us again next week. On behalf of Wendy McDougall and Peter Greco, this is Phil Vanderpeer bidding you all a very good night and hope that you'll join us again next week.